to learn about your creation and the care and the love that you put in to this place that we call Earth, our home, Lord. It demonstrates to us, Lord, how much deeply that you love each one of us, the human race, that you've put your spirit inside, and how you call us, Lord, to pause and to give thanks to you for being our Lord, our God, our Creator, and most of all, our Redeemer. We thank you, Lord Jesus, for coming and shedding your blood and paying the price that we couldn't pay, that we may have fellowship with you, and that we may come one day and be before your presence physically, Lord, whereas now we can boldly come to your presence in our spirit and our soul. Be with you as he teaches. Amen.
Well, I'm without the table today, so I'm going to just kind of sit down here with my computer, if you don't mind. Hopefully next week we'll get the table back. And, for all of those of you who do wind up going to the hospital for surgery, and that's pretty well all of us, that's going to happen. And Ross, just remember, when they ask you if you want a visit from a chaplain, tick that off, because they'll give you a wonderful opportunity to share your Christian faith with someone that doesn't know the Lord. Well, I kid you not. There was one time I was in the hospital where I got visited by five chaplains. Only one of them was a Christian. So, but it was a wonderful time just to share my faith with them. And it's not every day a chaplain runs into a scientist who's also a Bible teacher. So you take advantage of the opportunity. So, by the way, next week I hear is going to be the Wisteria Festival, which means you might want to look assiduously for a parking spot. I remember last year I had to park in Arcadia and walk up here, so give yourself a little extra time to get here. So, and I've been hearing rumors that they're going to be changing the class that's before us. And so I'll be giving you some details, but from what I understand, they're going to be putting two small classrooms in here, and this thing will be folded up, which means every Sunday we'll have to set it up for a big classroom. Now, they are offering us the Pritchard Hall, but I think it's to our advantage to have a facility that's a little more secular looking than the Pritchard Hall. So I'm going to do what we can to keep this room, but I might need a couple of volunteers to get here a little bit early so we can set the room up. So. But I'll give you details on that next week. So, I'm a little bit tired just because I, after class last Sunday, left to go back east, and I just got home late last night. So, three cities, Nashville, Charlotte, North Carolina, and Raleigh, North Carolina. And in Nashville, I was participating for a day at the National Religious Broadcasters. You know, we are on a few different radio and TV networks, so just stop to see how things are going there. One of the things we're planning at Reasons to Believe is to produce a 4 to 8 minute news video clip. We're actually setting up a small studio to make that possible and just lining up a number of networks that will carry that thing in their news format program. So that worked out pretty well. And one of the things that I learned by going back east, it's you don't quite feel it so much out here, but the influence of the young earth creationist community is very strong back there, much stronger than what I realized. And I particularly got to see that at the National Religious Broadcasters, is that you had all these booths for the different radio TV networks, and probably a good third to one half of the exhibition is on equipment. That was fun for me, just to walk around and see all the latest high-def equipment that's available. A little stunned at some of the prices, but that's kind of the reality. And just asking, well, you know, how long do I have to wait before the price drops by a factor of 10? So, but what was startling to me was to discover that by far the largest exhibitor there was Answers in Genesis. They had a booth about four times bigger than anybody else. So, and they were extremely aggressive on the floor. In fact, I visited the booth for the Gospel to Asia, and In fact, they were a little bit aggressive, too. They grabbed my arm and handed a book in front of me by their founder. I said, well, I've been meaning to read this all along. I've got a copy. And they said, well, take another one. And then they asked me why I was there. And I said, well, I'm representing Reasons to Believe. And said, what's that? So they'd never heard of it before. But I had these gals that were managing the booth just telling me, I said, you know, these people from Answers in Genesis are just so aggressive, and they're so upset that we don't take a stand on the age of the earth. In fact, we've been telling them, look, when you're ministering to Asia, there's no way you can tell the Asians that it's only 6,000 years old. Says, you know, the Asians are smart. They know better. So, but they said the Answers in Genesis folks were very, very aggressive. And said, you know, if you don't take a stand, then you're not taking a stand for Jesus Christ. So, but I had just had a chance to talk with them about why the Bible doesn't support a young earth interpretation. And by the time I was done, after about 20 minutes, these gals were all in tears. They just said, this is exactly what we need. Because, you know, we know we can't go with the young earth paradigm in Asia. But, you know, these guys from Answers in Genesis are just really beating us up with the fact that if you believe the Bible, it's got to be young earth. And just saying, well, you know, their name is Answers in Genesis. And the problem is, that's really all they look at is the book of Genesis. You really need to look at the other 65 books of the Bible and even show them how in the book of Genesis it's impossible to support a young earth interpretation. And it's amazing to me how many Christians, in going through the Bible, don't pick up on the fact there's no evening in the morning for the seventh day. I mean, age 17 is when I first read the Bible, and I went through Genesis 1, and it was obvious to me this has got to be six or seven long days. There's no evening and morning for the seventh day. I mean, that just seems straight obvious. And then you flip the page, and there you got the account of the creation of Adam and Eve. But notice it says in Genesis 1 that both the male and the human female were made on day 6. Then you see all the stuff that happens between the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve. And one of these things these gals had never recognized is the text actually says that Adam had the opportunity to watch the trees grow in the Garden of Eden. It's hard to see much tree growth in a few seconds at the end of a 24-hour day.
Where does it say that? What's the verse?
That's Genesis chapter 2. And another thing they didn't pick up on is that the text actually says that Adam was made outside of Eden. He wasn't made in the Garden of Eden, and they had never spotted that before. He was made outside the Garden of Eden. God put him in the Garden of Eden. And it's not clear whether he was watching the trees grow before he was placed into Eden or after or both. So that's the ambiguous part in Genesis 2. Well, I'll probably have to look it up. I'm just trying to take this off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
You always know the answer.
Yeah, but not the exact verse all the time. So let me see if I can find this for you.
I've never heard of that before.
Okay. It says the Lord in verse 11. The Lord took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and care for it. So that's the implication, that he was created outside of Eden and placed in the Garden of Eden. That's not 11? 15, pardon me. The Lord took the man and put him in the garden to work and take care of it.
What about the verse 5? And no shrub of the field had yet appeared on the earth, and no plant had sprung up.
No, that's not it. Verses 5 and 6. Because actually the chapter break should be at Genesis 2, verse 4. Because Genesis 2, verses 1 through 4 talk about the seventh day. And what you get in verses 5 and 6 is a quick summary of what's been described already in Genesis chapter 1. So it's giving you the preconditions for the Garden of Eden. That long before the Garden of Eden existed, there were no plants. What else does it say there?
Oh, and God, it's verse 9. God made all kinds of trees grow out of the ground.
Right.
After he had put the man there.
Right. So the trees are growing after he plants them.
Okay.
Because, yeah, the Answers in Genesis folks were saying that the trees were planted full grown, intact.
Yeah.
And actually the text here says no, that they're actually growing. Yeah.
Verse 5, 6, especially about, you know, it had not rained
Right.
Here.
Right.
I read one interpretation that was talking about a local agricultural time of year possible entrance.
Well, I believe the Garden of Eden is located in what is now the southeastern part of the Persian Gulf. That's the only place where the four rivers that are mentioned later on, verse 9 following, come together. They don't come together in Mesopotamia. But given that the calibration of the Genesis 11 genealogy puts the Garden of Eden events somewhere around 50 to 80,000 years ago, that means that that part of the world would be dry. The Red Sea would be dry. The Persian Gulf would be dry. The four rivers come together. Well, in that part of the geography, you don't get rain. Sometimes you get a fog. Sometimes you get a light mist. But it doesn't rain. In fact, what's interesting is in the Babylonian, the Babylonian language is a Sumerian and Akkadian. They don't have a word for large drops of water falling from the sky because it never happens in that part of the world. Now, they do in Hebrew. And what you're seeing contrasted here are the two Hebrew words, Ed and, Matar. Ed and Matar. And they're two Hebrew words, both meaning rain. But one means small drops falling from the sky. One means large drops falling from the sky. What you see here are small drops falling from the sky. That's because if it's in the Persian Gulf area, you're not going to get large drops falling from the sky. But this is not in any way supporting the young earth doctrine that there is no rain until the time of the flood. So, and incidentally, as you can see in the text here, it's specific to the Garden of Eden. It's not saying that there was no rain anywhere. It was saying there was no rain in the region of the Garden of Eden. But yeah, a number of liberal scholars would try to claim that Genesis 2, 5, and 6 contradict Genesis 1 because the order is different. Well, what you're getting is simply an abbreviated list of the events that you see in Genesis 1 in the context of the Garden of Eden. The liberal theologians are reading way too much into it. There's no sequencing language here in Genesis chapter 2 for the physical events. There are for the spiritual events, but not the physical events.
Is this still true today, that they get no rain in that book?
It's still true today, you don't get rain. So, they get precipitation, but not rain. Yeah, in the back, John. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, go, all right, you're both lining up with me, so it's hard. Well, go ahead. You can go first.
I was listening to a minister. He was saying, he must have been young earth, because I asked John about that there was never any rain anywhere until, you know, under the flood.
Right.
Until the flood. And so you're saying that's only in the Garden of Eden area.
Yeah. What you have in the Garden of Eden is a light rain. No heavy rain. There's a light rain.
He was trying to say it never rained on the whole earth until then.
Well, it's another way to refute that, because they're also claiming there are no rainbows until Noah saw the rainbow. But that contradicts what you see with the rest of the covenants that God signs with human beings. He always takes something familiar in the natural realm as a way to signify his promise, to seal the promise. So, given that water baptism, we're all familiar with the water, the bread and the wine, we're all familiar with that, why would the rainbow be the first time? It would be an exception with the other eight covenants we see in Scripture. All those other covenants, God uses something that's already familiar to the humans that he's signing the agreement with. So in that sense, there have to be rainbows before. And by the way, if you got a light mist, you also get a rainbow. Any of you who have had sprinkler systems know that's what happens with a light mist.
But before the Garden of Eden, there had to be rain, right? Doesn't the ocean make rain and all that stuff?
Yeah, there's got to be rain.
Right.
Yeah.
Be rain.
Otherwise,
it wasn't just a mist over the whole world.
Yeah, it's just that parts of the world get different parts of rain. And incidentally, given that Job 38 and 39 are a more ancient account of creation by 400 or 500 years than that in Genesis. Notice it says a whole lot more about precipitation than Genesis 1 and 2 do. Almost half of Job 38 is about precipitation. And it talks about God putting different kinds of precipitation in different parts of the world. Some places get snow, some places don't. Some get hail, some don't. Some get a fog, other parts don't. So that's all. You know, those of you who watch the Olympics will realize Vancouver gets a lot of fog. So in the wintertime, half the days I walked to school, the fog was so thick we couldn't see more than 10 feet. So that's what we got. Of course, we had rain on top of that, too. We had made all kinds of precipitation. So, yes?
Yeah, I'm a little confused here. If you use the old Earth interpretation, where do you put it on that time scale there? Is that at the beginning, when Genesis was written, for 4.7 million years ago, or where did it happen?
Okay, in terms of the six creation days, I mean, Genesis 1:1 is the beginning of the universe. That's when God creates the universe. Then it jumps ahead a little more than 9 billion years to the Earth. And you say, well, how come it doesn't describe those first 9 billion years? Well, there's plenty of other creation accounts that do, but Genesis does not. It omits that. And Genesis 1 typically omits those parts of the creation story that are explained in detail in the book of Job. Because Job predates Genesis, there's no need for Moses to repeat that which Job has already described. And so the part about what God was doing between the creation of the universe and the creation of earth, well, that was left to Job to deal with. And other prophets as well, Isaiah, Jeremiah, the psalmist, Zechariah, all deal what God was doing between the creation of the earth, or creation of the universe and the creation of the earth. Where creation day one starts would be the origin of life. And so roughly 3.8 billion years ago, you got the beginning of creation day one. In fact, what came up to me back east was, you know, how long are all these creation days? Well, what you can tell comparing the creation days with the geological record is that it appears that the days get shorter and shorter as you move from day one to day six. And looks like based on what the Bible teaches about the time of the end, the seventh day will be shorter than the sixth day.
What if there was a lot of earthquakes, 8.8, that tilted the earth?
Well, you know what? Everywhere I was back east, people were asking me about this big earthquake changing the tilt of the earth's rotation. And I can assure you it didn't change it by very much. And it also affects the rotation rate. But again, it doesn't change it by very much. It's such that nobody had to adjust their atomic clocks. That's how tiny it was.
Nobody knows what happened. I mean, it's
something that's been part of theological speculation literally for 3,000 years. It's called antipodalism. And it's something that concerned even Augustine. And he felt that it was critical that we had to have an equal number of people walking around in the southern hemisphere as we did in the northern hemisphere, because when you walk around, it disturbs the dynamics of the earth. Well, actually, he's right. When we do walk around, it does disturb the dynamics of the earth. But I can tell you, if we had the entire human population living in New Zealand, it still would have no measurable effect on the dynamics of the earth. But it does have a very tiny effect. So when you take a step, that does change the dynamics of the earth, the rotation rate and the tilt of the axis. But it was Augustine who said it's critical that we have people evenly distributed so that the way they disturb the dynamics of the earth would all balance out to zero. Now, that has an application. That's true of earthquakes. When you do get a big earthquake, it changes the tilt of the rotation axis of the earth and the rotation rate. But given the randomness of earthquakes, it all averages out to zero. So there's no net effect on the dynamics of the earth due to earthquakes. And in the past, when earthquakes were far more intense and frequent than they are today, likewise, it all balanced out to zero. Earthquakes have a zero net effect on the dynamics of the earth just because they take place fairly randomly over the face of the earth. But yeah, if we only had big earthquakes in Chile, over the course of billions of years, it would add up to a significant effect. But that 8.8 earthquake, they can barely detect with the most sophisticated instruments the influence it had. It did speed up the rotation rate a little bit, but not enough that we're going to have to worry about our calendars. Yes?
Steve, this is a bit of a non sequitur, but it does have to do with creation and the evolution of science. what one of your themes, of course, is that the Bible has remained unchanged in its position, and science has shifted from its eternal universe, the Aristotelian view. And something that's been on my mind for the past month is that the Aristotelian view doesn't address one of the most fundamental theological and philosophical questions that we can ask, and that is, why is there something instead of nothing? Why does anything at all exist? And I know in your latest email you address some of these issues of naturalism versus science.
Well, this must have come up, because when I was back east, I was getting this question all the time, can't nothing make something? And evidently there's been a well-publicized article up on the net to the effect that, it was Andre Linde many years ago, the theoretical physicist, who said that nothing is unstable, and that's where everything comes from. And what he was positing is that you can have literally nothing, and it bifurcates into something and anti-something. And so it all adds up to nothing. But the problem is, when we measure the universe, it doesn't have equal amounts of something and anti-something. It's got a little bit of an excess of something compared to anti-something. In fact, that was reflected in a book written in the 1980s called The Left Hand of Creation, making the point that everything we can measure in physics is very slightly asymmetrical. And so it's not true that the universe is equally balanced. It's closely balanced in terms of the number of electrons and neutrons. But that's because a requirement for life to exist is that the universe be electrically neutral. And that's one of the design features. I mean, the number of protons compared to the number of electrons is equal to better than 1 part in 10 to the 37. But that's because that's a critical ingredient for life. But it's also a critical ingredient for life that when something and anti-something get together, something's left over. If nothing's left over, we got nowhere to live. But there was actually an annihilation event in the universe when it was 10 to the minus 11 seconds old, when all the anti-something reacted with the something, an enormous release of energy as a result of that. But the universe we have today is that tiny piece left over. And how tiny we're talking about? Well, when the universe was created, there was 100 billion and 1 particles for every 100 billion antiparticles. And at the annihilation event, the 100 billion antiparticles annihilated the 100 billion particles, and the galaxy, stars, and planets are that one part in 100 billion that's left over. So the universe is a lot less massive today than it was in the beginning.
This reminds me a little bit of the multiverse that's cropped up since the Big Bang, coming out of the woodwork.
Well, one thing I told the people back east is this. Consider the timing. The timing of this proposal that nothing is unstable didn't happen until we came up with the space-time theorems of general relativity, which said there must be a God beyond space and time that created this universe of matter, energy, space, and time. Nobody was proposing this before, because if they did, they would have been laughed out of the physics lecture hall, the idea. Because, fundamentally, if nothing really is unstable, how come we don't see nothing producing something today? We'd never see that happening anywhere within the universe.
The space-time theorems tell us there was not only creation, but there was a creative force.
There was a creator, right.
And there was a creator.
Well, same thing with the multiverse.
If that's true for this universe, then it's true for the multiverse as well. That only compounds their problem, doesn't it?
Well, that's something Jeff Swearing pointed out in the book that we have here on the multiverse, is that these multiverse speculations were not proposed until the design argument became overwhelming. Even physicists who were atheists and agnostics were saying it was overwhelming evidence that there was design and therefore designer. Then they proposed the multiverse. However, all multiverse speculations are subject to the space-time theorems. And therefore, you don't get around God, but you do get around those, the idea that there's a personal God. And that's really the goal of physicists. As I talk to physicists today who are not Christians, they recognize they can't escape the idea that there's this agent beyond space and time that creates the universe of matter, energy, space, and time. They'll even admit that that's a supernatural agent, but they're reluctant to admit that it's a personal agent who would care for us human beings. And that's really what's motivating the multiverse, is to get around the personality of the Creator, not to get rid of God, but to get around the idea that He would have personal attributes. And if He has personal attributes, then that means He cares how we live our lives. And that's really what's going on, is physicists who would rather have a God to whom we're not answerable. So, but again, the timing is not a coincidence. Nobody was proposing this. So, but you'll see a short rebuttal in my book, More Than a Theory, and a longer one by Jeff Swearing. And incidentally, all multiverse speculations that the atheists are producing must have an open universe. And the geometric measurements for making the universe so far show it to be perhaps slightly closed. There's more evidence for closure than there is for openness, but it's not a done deal yet. But the Planck satellite that's orbiting right now may have the power to put to rest all multiverse speculations coming from an atheistic perspective. So we might have that answer.
Because it might say that your universe is closed.
Because it may show that there's not a possibility that the universe would be open. Because these models do demand an open universe. In the back, John.
Yes, I was wondering with regard to precipitation in Eden, whether there's a good rendering of the noun would be what we call drizzle. Maybe that was the...
Well, that word matar could be drizzle, fog, mist. The bottom line, its base definition, is small drops of water falling in the sky. Technically, it's still rain.
But it could include drizzle, so we can...
Yeah. What it rules out is the idea that you've got a downpour situation, where you've got big drops coming down in a heavy rain. So this would be a light rain with small drops. But it's still rain. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Every earthquake will do a little bit.
Some milliseconds per year or something like that, but some very small amount. But I was wondering, are these calculated or are these observed changes? Because I know you can calculate the effect of a flea jumping that 2 centimeters or something. That upsets the location.
In the case of the Chilean earthquake, they were actually able to measure it.
Oh, okay.
But it was very tiny. So,
I just remember what the values were.
I don't recall the values. So.
But it makes a great story.
Well, I mean, what disturbed me is back east, I was hearing people saying that a rotation axis, because of the Chilean earthquake, tilted over by 3 degrees. So, the 3 probably stuck in their mind. It's probably 0.00000, you know, and then you get a 3. Yeah, but it certainly wasn't 3 degrees. It would take a rather big earthquake to do that.
Just a little commercial for JPL. If you really want to know what difference it makes in the rotations of the Earth, JPL tracks this, because the big tracking antennas are on the surface of the Earth, and they have to follow spacecraft with great accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So we have something called DUT, which is the difference in universal time, and there are polynomials that they use to track these little variations in the Earth's rotation. So very small, minute differences do show up in these polynomials.
But I'm guessing they can't measure the effect when I walk around this room.
No.
No. Or the waves crashing on the shore of the beach. Okay. Well, I want to make sure we get into our Bible lesson today, so I'm just going to give a quick rundown of what happened when I was back east there and then move on into our lesson. I was there primarily to talk to Trans World Radio, and what's really neat is they want to help us reach out to particularly Asia and Brazil. They kind of target us and said, you guys are producing intellectual content that will help bring people of faith in Christ in these countries, and we want to help you. So basically what they're offering us is to take our website and create similar websites in all these different languages where we can make available our podcasts, our articles, and even our video. So we're going to see if we can make that happen. And... I was also there to develop a partnership with Southern Evangelical Seminary. It's the one seminary in the country, very conservative, holds to biblical inerrancy, naturally, because it was founded by Norm Geisler. But their real mission is to train pastors and theologians in apologetics. So the biggest course factor is apologetics, and they want to form a partnership with us. And also work with us to reach out to other seminaries. And what I'm realizing is there's a real concern in the seminaries to the current threats of open theism and middle knowledge and theistic evolution. And so there's actually a movement for these conservative seminaries to kind of join forces together to deal with these theological challenges. So we're going to be part of that coalition. And we got to sign some agreements back there to make that happen. The other thing that we did is that we formed a relationship with a group called Ratio Christi. They're from South Africa, but they've invaded the United States. And their whole mission is looking at the campus scene and recognizing it's filled with all these Christian clubs. But none of the Christian clubs have an apologetics focus. And so they're going on the campus not to start a competing club, but to be a service to all the clubs that are there. And they recognize they needed the help of Reasons to Believe to make that happen. So I actually did two Ratio Christi events while I was there at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte and University of North Carolina State, which is in Raleigh. So, and you know, both are very strong in the sciences. In fact, at North Carolina State, the audience was probably 50% faculty, students, and then some community people. But in both places, I thought for sure these would be two places where I wouldn't run into a young earth problem, but not so. And the faculty members, they were telling me just how much of a problem it is. They had these students come into the classrooms, and they said they're all trying to convert us to a young earth position. So they were just asking for some assistance from us. They didn't even know the Book of Matter of Days existed. And it says, well, the young earth creationists work hard to make sure people don't know it exists. So, and then I did a radio show, and the guy said, look, in order for this show to work, it was three radio shows, but he says the first show is going to have to be taking on the young earth creationists. And they didn't even tell me this. I just walked into the studio and said, we're going to have you a few questions from all these young earth creationist apologists. And I said, well, okay, I left my book and material at home, but we'll see how it goes. Fielded 15 questions in an hour. But then he says, that's the only way we would have the right to actually interview you about the scientific evidence, is we have to first deal with the young earth challenge. And he just mentioned how much of a pressure the seminary is under from the young earth creationist community. But he also assured me 100% of their faculty are old earth. They really like Reasons to Believe. It's the first seminary campus I've been on where they're all on our mailing list, and they all really appreciate what we're trying to do and are really eager to work out a partnership with us. We'll actually be teaching some classes with them. So that was the primary reason why I was back there, but I also got to speak on those two campuses. And the other fun thing was when I was taking the bus back from the National Religious Broadcasters, a fellow behind me just started talking to me. And he was talking about, said, did you see that booth from Answers in Genesis? And I said, yeah. He said, it was right in the middle that dominated the whole thing. And, you know, why are they at a National Religious Broadcasters? They should be at some other kind of convention. Because they said, well, they do have a TV and a radio show. So, and again, he talked about how aggressive they were towards him. And he mentioned he had a ministry in India. So, But then he said, you know, the thing we found that works best with India is this book that we have called The Creator and the Cosmos. You know what I mean about it? So we got to talking, and it turns out he's on our mailing list, a real fan of the ministry. But he says, you know, we've been meaning to contact you guys because we're wanting to translate your material into Hindi and to get it into India. So, well, he's actually going to come out to here to Southern California and meet with us. Yeah?
As strong as young earth creationism is in that part of the country, do you get the feeling over the last 5, 10, 15 years, is young earth creationism growing in popularity? Is it getting less, smaller? What's the current general trend?
Well, I was expecting it to be a lot weaker. But what I discovered in going to the East Coast is it seems to be stronger than it was the last time I was there. And I think I went to the Answers in Genesis website. They have a lot of money. And they're using their money to take out ads on television, radio, newspapers, even USA Today. And they're very aggressive at going after the churches. So I think it's the wealth that's causing it to get the blip. But there's also a negative reaction in the sense that they're just being too aggressive. And that's what I noticed at the National Religious Broadcasters, is everybody was pretty upset at the aggressive nature in which they're saying, you can only promote our view and nothing else. So, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, I'm rather stunned that it, and in fact, what was interesting, when I was at North Carolina State, which is a very heavy science-focused university. In fact, I was speaking in a lecture hall in the physics department, and they have 100 physics professors and over 100 graduate students. I mean, you know, this is a powerhouse in that area. And yet even there, young Earth creationism was being strongly promoted. And there was even a faculty member that was promoting it. And he kept insisting. And what I noticed is that they're trying to claim there's powerful scientific evidence for a young Earth position. That, I think, is new. I haven't been running into that before. Because, you know, I was kind of explaining to them from the Bible why a young Earth position is acceptable. And he says, well, you know, I can see where you might read that in the Bible, but look at the scientific evidence. It's all against you. And I said, what are you talking about? So I just kind of challenged the guys, you know, come up with your best scientific evidence, and I'll try to explain to you why the scientific community doesn't see them as acceptable. So, and the one they were hitting me with all the time was the salt in the ocean. So they thought that was a slam dunk. There's way too much salt in the ocean. I said, yeah, but don't you understand? It recirculates. Where do you think we get the salt that's sitting in Minnesota from? That was an ocean at one time. And but, you know, they don't believe in a 100-million-year cycle. So but just trying to explain to them why the scientists. And it helped, too, that I was able to talk to them about debates I did with younger creationist leaders where the host simply asked them, have you ever seen a scientist independent of the Bible go from an old Earth position to a young Earth position? Every time I've been in a debate like that, the younger creationist has always said no. Even Dwayne Gish, in 40 years of ministry, said, I've never seen a single scientist go from an old Earth to a young Earth position. Well, you don't have to know a lot of science to realize there can't be a lot of credibility if you got zero converts over 40 years. So, but I was shocked at just how strong the young Earth influence was back there, and how much stronger it seems to be now than it was in the past.
Hugh, I wonder if they're being aggressive because they feel threatened.
Oh, they do feel threatened. But I think, too, it has a lot to do with the money they got. That museum was a financial windfall for them. And I think they were well aware they were going to get lots of Christians to see it, but they had no idea they were going to get so many non-Christians to see it. But the problem is the non-Christians that come are coming there for the comedic impact. You know, get their picture taken on top of a dinosaur kind of thing. So, yep, there's a saddle and a dinosaur. And you can get your picture taken riding a T-Rex, so.
I have a good bumper sticker for RTV. I see young
Earth. Wow.
Isn't that the place down there where these people really believe in the speaking in tongues and handling rattlesnakes?
Answers in Genesis flatly denies that. That's been pinned on them, but they flatly deny that. And I believe them. They don't believe that stuff. But they do believe that there were dinosaurs on board the ark, and that humans and dinosaurs walked together, and that the dinosaurs were friendly. Even T-Rex was a vegetarian. So... And so, yep, they believe the dinosaurs rapidly evolved after they got off the ark. And so, well, that's what was interesting, is just talking to the folks there saying, you know, do you realize that young Earth creationists believe in evolution more aggressively than any atheist does? And that's something I hadn't really thought through, but it's true. Anyway, they talk a line against evolution, but they are the most passionate evolutionists around. And it's because they believe there were no carnivores until the fall. Well, how do you explain the carnivores? Rapid evolution. And then how do you explain all the animals we have today if there's only a few thousand on board the ark? That's rapid evolution. So, anyway, it's amazing to me this movement still exists. It really is.
When the ark landed, if all those things were on board, they would have sank in about 20 feet of mud.
Slime.
Well, to their credit, young Earth creationists recognize you can't put millions of species on board the ark. So there's only thousands. Even thousands would be a tough one, but they also believe the animals hibernated during the entire 13 months, so they didn't have to be fed. So didn't have to clean up after them either. But of course, their science is wrong on that. Hibernating animals do need to urinate and they need to drink. So you do have to take care of them. But anyway, let's move on. So last week, I just want to wrap up this stuff about the anomalous. We talked about the anomalous poisons, vital poisons, carbon, nitrogen, fluorine, sodium. And you get the point here. When you look at planet Earth compared to what we would expect for Earth-type planets in our solar system, Earth is anomalous in every respect, sometimes by more than a factor of 1,000. And these are all elements where if you got too much, you'll be killed. If you got too little, you'll be killed. Here's sulfur. Earth is the only sulfur-poor planet in our solar system. Potassium has got 90 times more potassium, 9 times more vanadium, 5 times less chromium, nickel 20 times less. Again, these are all vital poisons. You need them in your diet. But too much will kill you. Too little will also kill you. Cobalt is included in this list. Selenium, molybdenum, tin, iodine. And then we come to what are called the anomalous vital metals. And you'll kind of take for granted that here on planet Earth, we have light metals. Aluminum and titanium are light metals. But notice that titanium is 65 times more abundant than it should be, and aluminum 40 times more abundant. If they were at the normal abundance level, we wouldn't have aluminum or titanium technology. And we're all very grateful for that. We wouldn't be able to fly in airplanes if it wasn't for aluminum and titanium. And a couple you probably aren't aware of that I mentioned last week is yttrium and niobium. Say, what is so important about yttrium and niobium? They're the only elements in the periodic table that allow for liquid nitrogen superconducting phenomena. And therefore, we don't have the engineering yet in place, but it won't be long before we'll have superconducting technology giving us electricity at very low prices, because with superconductivity, you get zero resistance, which is going to allow for the transmission of a lot more electricity at much lower prices. And we don't have to use liquid helium if you got yttrium and niobium. And look how much more abundant they are than what we would expect anywhere else in the universe for an Earth-type planet. By the way, if I can go back there, calcium, I want to give credit to Jocelyn, who told me last week that calcium really should be on the list of vital poisons. Because if you got too much calcium, it's going to cause you problems. Too little will cause you problems. I checked the list of vital poisons, and the reason why it's not on that list is that technically it won't kill you. It'll just make life really uncomfortable for you if you take too much calcium. So, but I think I would agree with you, Jocelyn. It really should be on that list of vital poisons, because if you take too much calcium, it's going to make your life really, really uncomfortable. And likewise, if you don't take enough, it's going to be a problem. You don't take enough, it will kill you. But the vital poisons have been reserved for those elements where if you don't have enough, it will kill you. If you don't have, if you have too much, it will also kill you. And that's why calcium wasn't on that list. But yeah, it's going to make life really uncomfortable. Jocelyn, I'll let you speak first since you were the one that recommended this. Right, you get little bone spurs, which is going to really inflame your joints. So, yeah, too much calcium is not good. But it's also important to make sure you get enough calcium that you don't have osteoporosis taking place. And so you want to have just the right amount of calcium in your diet. But as I understand it, the reason why it didn't make the list of vital poisons, too much will not kill you, although too little will.
Too much calcium can also give you kidneys.
Give you kidney stones, and yeah, and they're not pleasant either, are they? No. I have never had kidney stones, but Fuzz Ron on our staff has had them, and he did some research on it, and I think he found out that it's about the most painful thing a human being can go through, especially if the stones are big.
I had a nurse come to wheel me down to x-ray with one.
Yeah.
She came in and she said, oh, well, let me see your chart. Let's see what's wrong with you. And she looked at that and she said, oh, a kidney stone. She said, I've had two babies and I'd rather have another one and raise it.
That tells you how bad a kidney stone is. Go ahead.
Yeah, aren't yttrium and niobium sufficiently rare, even though they're, you know, got those multiples of what they should have, aren't they sufficiently rare that there isn't enough of it to support a massive infrastructure use of it, like electrical transmission?
Yttrium and niobium, especially yttrium, is quite abundant in the crust of the earth. It's much more abundant than a lot of these other elements. The problem is it binds with a lot of other compounds. The problem is trying to get pure yttrium out of the earth's crust. But where they are getting it is aluminum smelting, because the way you pull aluminum out of the crust of the earth is that you use electrolysis. You basically liquefy the ore, and then you use electrolysis to pull off the aluminum. Well, what you can do is pull off any element you want just by matching the number of protons. You can, and that's where they're literally getting the yttrium and niobium is from electrolysis. So as long as we're making lots and lots of aluminum, we're going to have all the yttrium we want. But it is difficult to keep in a form that is useful. And right now, with the yttrium and niobium, they can make ceramics that would be superconducting at liquid nitrogen temperatures, but it's hard to make a 1,000-mile-long tube of a ceramic. And that's kind of the challenge right now, is how can we develop compounds with yttrium and niobium that would be ductile, where we can make a nice long pipe and fill it up with liquid nitrogen and transmit all the electricity we want at very low cost. But they already have it at ceramic levels. And you could make a long tube of a ceramic material, but now it's not a cheap tube anymore. And so the goal is to come up with a cheap tube. But the problem is not the lack of yttrium and niobium. There's plenty of that stuff, but you got to make sure you got adequate aluminum smelting going on. And right up until recently, the aluminum smelters have not bothered to pull off niobium and yttrium. They were pulling off the gold, pulling off the silver and the copper. In fact, they were pulling off enough gold to pay for the whole process of the electrolysis. But what they're now discovering is they can pull off every element on the atomic chart. And so there are aluminum smelters that are actually doing that because we're recognizing these elements are not useless. And if you look at the periodic table, every element there has a use for modern technology. And therefore, it is now a more concerted effort to go after those elements. But yeah, if you were just to kind of try to find a yttrium mine, there aren't any yttrium mines around. There aren't any niobium mines around either, even though it's abundant in the crust of the earth. Okay, moving on. We have four more I want to discuss. It's gold, lead, and then uranium and thorium, and then we'll get back into Psalm 139. This is where we ended up last week, is that with gold, we have five times less than what we'd expect. This is kind of a big anomaly, because the earth is super rich in the very heavy elements, except for gold. Gold is the one exception, and we don't have a lot of it. And as I mentioned last week, the little bit of gold that we do have is really thanks to an asteroid colliding in South Africa. That's where 80% of our mined gold comes from, is South Africa, and it comes from this asteroid that crashed into there, similar to where the nickel comes from. Half of the nickel that we have comes from an asteroid that collided in Canada. There's a nickel mine outside of Sudbury where they're just mining that old asteroid. Likewise, the gold in South Africa, which really means we have a lot less than this five times less. It's much less than that if we were simply to ignore that asteroid. And this is important because gold is not a nutrient, but it is toxic. Too much gold in your body is a real problem. And I did a little study this morning on the toxicity of gold, and this is what it can do for you. Too much gold in your body will give you pulmonary diseases. It gives you heart disease. It'll get you kidney stones. It will mess up your renal system. The liver's not affected. It's just your kidneys, your lungs, and your heart. So, and there's also a problem with the brain. Your ability to think will be negatively impacted with too much gold. So, yeah, so, you know, you want to stay away from gold, right? Yeah, no problem staying away from gold, okay. But what's good is the gold that we do have is concentrated in that one little spot of South Africa, which means the rest of the planet has gold-impoverished soils. And because the soils are gold-impoverished, we don't get too much gold when we eat our vegetables. And therefore, we don't run into all these diseases. Now, the reason why there's research on gold toxicity is they're now coming up with drugs that are gold-rich. And they're realizing that they have to very carefully monitor the patients to whom they give this gold to. There's treatment of AIDS and other diseases that are positively affected by these gold drugs. But there they got to watch the kidney system, make sure they don't give it to them for too long. Yes? Well, if the gold passes right through you, you're probably okay. But I wouldn't eat anything with gold leaf on it because gold reacts very easily with mercury. And if you've got mercury amalgam teeth, there will be a problem. So, do be careful. So you might want to stay away from those gold leaf chocolates. Well, the thing about gold is that you can make the foil extremely thin. You can even make it at just one atom thick, which means that even if you were to eat gold foil, you're not really consuming much gold because it is so extremely thin. And again, if it doesn't react with anything in your stomach as it goes through, you'll be okay. Although I did read that gold will also constipate you, so another reason why you might want to avoid those gold chocolates. So... in the back.
Did the asteroid come from a gold-rich planet? Where did asteroid come from?
Okay, the asteroid probably, it's the broken-up remains of planetary formation. And we do observe that 25% of the asteroids in the main belt are what we call stainless steel asteroids, where they're mostly iron, but also very rich in cobalt and nickel. And so the asteroid that struck us, Sudbury, Ontario, was a nickel-rich asteroid. But there's also other heavy elements that can be concentrated in an asteroid, and the one that hit in South Africa was golden-rich. It wasn't pure gold, but its density of gold is such that we get 80% of the planet's gold comes from that one spot. But my point is, we probably got gold impoverishment that's way less than that five times. We're probably looking at 20, 25, 30 times less gold than what we'd otherwise expect. Now, this is an unsolved problem because we would expect the planet Earth would be gold-rich compared to other planetary bodies because we understand there were events in the history of the Earth that caused our planet to become much richer in heavy elements and much poorer in light elements. Indeed, Earth is the densest body in the solar system. And so given that it had these events that greatly increased its density beyond what we would normally expect, why do we have so little gold? So I don't have an answer for that. That's an unsolved problem. Why Earth has so little gold? But the fact that it does have so little gold really makes advanced life possible. We couldn't live on this planet if it had a normal gold enrichment. We would all be poisoned at an early age. And we wouldn't be able to think. I mean... it's important that you not have too much gold running around in your head. So it's okay to have it in your pocket, but don't have it in your head. Yes.
Where was gold and uranium and these really super heavy elements created? In the supernova?
Yes.
How does gold compare to uranium?
Okay, gold, uranium, and thorium all come from supernova eruptions. The only place you can get gold is in a supernova eruption. And we believe one reason why our Earth is so uranium and thorium rich is that it was enriched by a nearby supernova eruption. But the challenge is this. how come we got all this uranium and thorium and so little gold? What would cause the gold to be selected out? And we don't know the answer to that yet, but we do know that that's critical to have advanced life here on planet Earth, that we be so gold poor. Now, the lead that we see here, we know where the lead came from. The lead basically came from the decay of uranium and thorium. Most of the uranium and thorium that's in the crust of the Earth has undergone decay. That's what's producing all this lead. And so the lead, so when uranium and thorium undergo radiometric decay, it produces helium and lead. And so, in fact, we see three different kinds of lead. There's lead 206, 207, and 208. Incidentally, lead in the universe only comes from radiometric decay. So it's not something that you make, it's something that's the direct result of the decay of these two elements. And uranium, thorium-232 makes lead-208 when it decays. Uranium-235 makes lead-207. And uranium-238 makes lead-206. So that's where all the lead comes from, and that's why we got so much of it, because look how much of the uranium and thorium we have. Yes?
Does gold react like uranium and
thorium? Gold will react with mercury. And so, in fact, that's one way that people have mined gold, is that they will pour your mercury over an ore, and then they pull back the mercury and separate the gold from the mercury. But gold will react with a few, especially highly reactive agents. So there are gold salts out there. But that's what you got to watch out for. And you're talking about the gold chocolates. What's really dangerous for human beings are gold salts, as opposed to the pure gold, because it's hard to assimilate the pure gold. It's the gold salts. But our soils are filled with gold salts. And as I mentioned last week, my mother, who was a nurse, actually treated a man in World War II who had gold poisoning. And the problem was where she was doing her nursing in Quebec, the soils were gold rich. And so they had to import vegetables outside of Quebec and feed them to this guy in order he could recover from his gold poisoning. Yeah?
I thought the bulk of uranium and thorium came from the Mars seismic.
There's several contributors to the uranium and thorium. There's three different kinds of supernova that the primordial solar system experienced that super enriched it with uranium and thorium. There would be the aluminum 26 that the emerging solar nebula got that blew off the light stuff, thereby concentrating the heavy stuff. Then there would be the Mars-sized collider, which would have given us an additional enrichment of uranium and thorium. And finally, there's a late heavy bombardment. So those are the five sources of uranium and thorium that we have here in the Earth. It is a bit mystifying to astronomers why it's this high. I mean, we would anticipate with those kinds of events that maybe it would be 500 times higher, but the fact that it measures 16,000 times higher and 23,000 times higher. In fact, this may be an underestimate. Some astronomers believe that the Earth has three cores. You know, the kind of standard geophysical model is that we have a solid iron core that's wrapped with a liquid iron core, and in that iron is mixed up with some nickel and cobalt and uranium and thorium. But there's seismic measurements are showing us that we may be wrong on that presumption, and that really the Earth's interior would be a solid ball of uranium surrounded by a solid ball of iron, nickel, and cobalt surrounded by a liquid core predominantly made up of iron, nickel, and cobalt with infusions of a little bit of sulfur and oxygen. So if we have a uranium core, then that pushes us up quite a bit more.
Okay.
Yeah. Depending how you classify them, there's four or five different kinds of supernova. And to explain all the elements we see here on planet Earth, our solar nebula must form adjacent to three of those five different kinds. Now, it may have formed adjacent to more, but at least three of those five kinds. And as I mentioned, it must also form close to asymptotic giant branch stars and white dwarf binary stars in order to explain some of the lighter elements like fluorine and selenium that show up at such at their abundance levels. So, and pardon me, I don't want to be wrong on this. Uranium and thorium here are for the crust of the Earth. This does not take into account the uranium and thorium in the interior of the Earth. So yeah, there may be a lot more uranium in the interior of the Earth than we've accounted for so far. That being the case, then it really is mystifying, where do we get all this uranium? That seems like way too much for even our current. So we're probably still missing some supernatural interventions that pushed it up to this very high level. Yeah, John in the back.
I was wondering if anyone's estimated the present internal energy production from uranium and thorium. Is there any way to detect how much continual, in addition to the existing internal temperatures, how much is being supplied by conversion of radioactive decay?
Well, the reason why the interior of the Earth is hot is because of the uranium and thorium.
Whether they've quantified the amount of present energy conversion, that would have been able to, then you could infer the...
Well, you're asking how much we could exploit this stuff for energy?
No, how we could estimate the actual internal content of uranium and thorium as the internal...
Yeah, that's a little bit difficult to do. I think I know what you're saying. Let's just measure the heat flow coming from the interior of the Earth and see if that'll allow us to determine the uranium and the thorium that exists there.
Yes.
Those heat flow measurements are a little bit complicated to make. And it'd be one thing if you could go down at the core boundary and make the measurements. Then you could really get somewhere. But we can't really drill a probe down to the core of the Earth and take a thermometer down there and see what's going on. That's not possible. What we're trying to do is make measurements in the crust. And the problem with making measurements in the crust, there's a lot of additional heat and cooling sources that make it very difficult to pull out exactly what that heat is. So, yes?
You mentioned helium in passing. Is that helium that's created in the uranium decay responsible for basically all the free helium we see here on the Earth? Because helium escapes very rapidly.
Helium escapes very rapidly, and the helium you buy on the industrial market, 100% of it comes from nuclear power stations and nuclear bomb manufacture. In fact, 20 years ago, that was a classified piece of information, how much helium the U.S. government actually had in store. Because if you knew how much helium we had, then you would know how many bombs we were making. But that's no longer classified. That's where all our helium comes from, is the power plants and bomb manufacture.
Is it true that if all the heat in the core of the Earth were on the surface, we'd be a star?
Well, it depends on your definition. For example, we could technically rank Jupiter as a star because it does have internal heat. It has internal heat not because of uranium and thorium, but because it's undergoing gravitational collapse. And the energy released from gravitational collapse makes Jupiter about 3 or 4 degrees warmer than it otherwise would be. It turns out that the heat release we get from the uranium and thorium doesn't make much of a difference in the surface temperature of our planet. The heat that's being trapped by our atmosphere is far greater than the heat we get from uranium and thorium. On the other hand, if you're a coal miner, when you go down into the earth, you will feel the heat from uranium and thorium. And if people who mine coal, for example, get exposed to a lot more radiation than the rest of us. So coal miners typically don't live as long as the rest of the population because of all the exposure they get to uranium and thorium. And all you got to do is go down a mile into the crust of the Earth, and you will feel the effect of the heat from uranium and thorium as well as the radiation. Yeah?
I was thinking when we get our new bodies, new Earth, new heavens, will these metals change to fit with our new bodies? Because the metals should change if everything's renewed.
Well, given that in the new creation, we're not going to have the physics that we have in this universe or its dimensions, there may not be any of these elements available. They may be replaced with something completely different. So you might not have to worry about selenium poisoning or chromium poisoning in the new creation for watching your diet. So. Well, it talks about streets of gold in heaven and streets of glass. Those are metaphors because in Roman culture, what you see listed in Revelation 21 are the most expensive things that was available. And by the way, at that time, clear glass was more expensive than gold, which is why it mentions, you know, clear glass in the new creation. So it's basically telling us there's unimaginable wealth in the new creation. Hey, I'm actually running out of time here, so let me just kind of wrap this up. With uranium and thorium, I wanted to make the point that this is now having tremendous industrial applications that weren't even noticed until just a few years back. And so this is what, let me pull this up here for you. Yeah, here we go. That's pitch blend, and that's what pure uranium looks like. It's basically a silvery metal. How'd that get in there? Anyway, that little slug you saw there, that's actually a shell that our U.S. Army fires out of its tanks towards other tanks, and is made out of depleted uranium. And it's because it's the second densest metal we have here in the planet. And you say, why don't they use a densest metal? Well, the densest metal is gold. And there's not enough gold around that we can turn them into shells. Exactly. Moreover, gold is soft. Gold is very dense, but it's soft, and it's extremely rare. And the reason why they use depleted uranium is because it's so very abundant. There's way more uranium on the planet than there is tin, for example. And so our armed forces are using that uranium as a projectile to penetrate armor. Moreover, our military is using depleted uranium for armor plate. It's way better than any kind of steel because of its extreme density and the fact that you can mold it just like steel, and it's almost as hard as steel, but with its great density, it actually provides a lot more armor protection than any other metal we have on the planet. And also they're discovering that it's the best metal to protect occupants from radiation, which is kind of weird, the idea that uranium, which is radioactive, would be a very good shield against radiation, whilst depleted uranium. Now, depleted uranium is a slug of uranium where they take the uranium-235 out. That's the stuff that's got a short, relatively short half-life and is quite dangerous to be around. Uranium-238 also is radioactive. But it's not nearly as deadly as uranium-235. So if you take the 235 out, you've got this slow radioactive metal, and it actually is better than lead at protecting occupants from radiation. It's better than any metal we know to protect people from radiation. And also, it's very abundant, so we can actually make plates of this stuff and use that to shield people from radiation. In fact, it probably won't be very long before when you go into the dentist's office and you get an x-ray, they'll put a uranium thing over you instead of a lead thing over you because it would actually be better at protecting you from the x-ray that you get at your dentist or the x-rays you get when you go and have your lungs checked or whatever. So uranium, I believe, is going to become a much more popular industrial metal than we have right now because it is the second densest metal that we have in the chart of elements. Protects us from radiation, and it's just like steel. It's ductile and quite hard. There's really nothing like it. And then we happen to live in a planet that has such a super abundance of this stuff that we can exploit it to our heart's content. So, well, next week I'm going to jump straight into Psalm 139. I didn't intend this to take quite this long, but hey, we had some good discussion. So we'll do that. Next week I'll give you an announcement, too, about the restructuring of this class. I presume that you're all with me, that you'd rather stay here than go into Pritchard Hall. Yeah, I think this is a much more conducive environment for the kind of people we want to invite as guests. So I'll do what I can to make sure that happens. Okay. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the blessing of living on this amazing planet that you designed just for us. And Father, I ask that you would give insight to the research scientists that are trying to solve the unproblems of why we got so much sulfur, why we got such so much uranium and thorium, and why so little gold. Lord, we understand a lot of the anomalies we see here in the periodic table, and we see how your hand is miraculous in me and made all this possible so that we could live here on this planet and enjoy a high-tech civilization. Father, I pray you would give us insight so we can see even more of your handiwork on our half, on our behalf. Thank you, Lord, for loving us to such a degree to bless us with just the right amounts of everything we need, not too much and not too little. And Lord, we thank you that that also applies in the spirit realm. Lord, that you reveal yourself to us in a way that's optimized so that we can receive from you your grace and, Lord, your gift that you made available to us on the cross. Father, I pray as we go from here, you give us many opportunities to share the good news of how we can be eternally secure with you in a fulfilling relationship with you for the rest of eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.
The one advantage, there are a couple of advantages to Pritchard Hall, just thinking about it.
It's a little bigger, that's
well,
for sure.
It's certainly bigger. It's also right immediately adjacent to child care.
Mm-hmm.
So if we do happen to be bringing in any of the younger families, mm-hmm. which I think is a great target area, that is more comfortable because they are right there. They can go see their kids. They're not